Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. This episode, I interview Lalit Marcus and Eric Trinidad. They are both travel writers with a wealth of experience visiting and chronicling amazing locations around the world. Lalit is contributing digital editor for Condé Nast Traveler and is also a journalist and author of the book Save the Assistants. Trinidad is the host, director, and producer of the science and travel web series Plausibly Ridiculous, and his travel writing has appeared in a wide variety of publications. While the majority of their travel experiences have been positive, I began this interview by asking Lalit and Eric to describe their most frightening encounter in a foreign city. And for Lalit, that city was Athens in Greece.
You know, I travel a lot. I travel by myself most of the time. Being a travel writer kind of means that you travel at weird times of the year and people can't usually go with you. And I've had pretty good luck in terms of street harassment and stuff, but I arrived back from Crete on a boat that got in at like 5 a.m. on a Sunday. The whole city was just dead. And while I was walking back to my hostel, this guy started following me and he kept getting closer and closer. And I would do these things like try to switch sides of the street that I was on, and he would do the exact same thing that I had just done. And actually, so there are a lot of stray dogs in Greece, but most of them are friendly and they have their shots and they're considered like communal pets. And one of them decided that he was going to take care of me. And this dog like followed me the entire rest of the way and stayed between the guy and me. And then I made it to my hotel, which luckily had 24-hour reception. And once I got in, it was fine. But it was a really unsettling experience. And it's really scary because I had so much stuff with me. I was really weighed down. I knew that I wouldn't be able to run if I needed to.
And on that note, Eric, do you consider that a luxury, being a man traveling abroad?
I've been mugged at knife point in Cape Town. I would still recommend Cape Town to anyone. It's a lovely city. I always knew that one day I'd get mugged on the street while traveling. And everyone says, like, you're supposed to talk to the attacker, talk to the mugger, and like, it'll calm him down because he's also in a frenzy. The thing is, like, when you have a knife to your stomach, like, you don't think of any of that. Like, everything that you're like, everything is becomes instinctive. And you just give him your money. Like, it happened, it wasn't even nighttime yet. It was around dusk. I was walking down a side street in a backpacker neighborhood. Just a man and a boy who looked like they were on the way to the restaurant on the corner were just walking around. And then when they were 10 feet in front of me, they just like bum rushed me. The man held a knife to my stomach and just directed the kid to empty my pockets. And there's no way that I could think to even have a conversation with them. So I just like gave him my money. I gave him my camera. I had a hidden pocket like behind me where my passport was there. But because there's no like access to it, unless I took off my pants, which I wasn't going to do, they left my passport alone. So I was safe on that. Fortunately, I had just backed up all my photos off my camera like the day before. So I didn't really lose that much. I just lost a bunch of credit cards. The worst that came out of it was this happened a day before I was supposed to leave Cape Town. And like I asked for a replacement credit card and they wouldn't get to me before I left. So I was stuck in Cape Town for another week, which fucked up all my inter-Africa flights. It was a blessing in disguise because I actually ended up going overland through public transportation across sub-Saharan Africa, which was a whole other thing, you know, a whole other adventure instead of just flying everywhere.
Both Lalit and Eric were good enough to share with me some of their favorite travel writing work ahead of this interview. And so we're going to go and touch on some of those great stories. I'm going to start with you, Lalit. This is very timely. We're talking in the wake of the death of Fidel Castro. Earlier this year, you, for Condé Nast Traveler, you embarked on a boat journey to Cuba that was very historic. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it was a really cool experience. I was on the first commercial cruise from the United States to Cuba in 50 years. So, you know, it was a really cool experience anyway. I was excited about going to Cuba. It's a week-long cruise that went to Havana, Cienfuegos, and Santiago de Cuba. So I was excited about getting to see a couple different parts of the country. And I think the further you get from Havana, the less touristy the country is. It's pretty hard to get around over land there, so you run into a lot fewer people. And it was run by a company called Fathom, who is actually not going to be running these cruises anymore. They're a sub-brand of Carnival, so I think they're getting folded back into Carnival. And that's a pretty recent development. But the Cuba cruises have been really popular. What was crazy about it, though, is for me, it was such a cool experience. I was just really excited about going to Cuba. We left from Miami at night. We were going to be pulling into Havana around 7 or 8 the next morning. And we got sort of a debrief the night before about make sure you have your passports, make sure you have your Cuban visa, all the stuff that we would need when we arrived at the port in the morning. But they really downplayed how interested Cuban people would be in us arriving. You know, we thought they were going to hate us. We thought they wouldn't be happy to see Americans. There were a lot of other countries where people moved up their trips to Cuba because they wanted to go before the Americans ruined it. So I was expecting it to be really anticlimactic for the Cubans. And I thought I would just walk off the boat and then start walking around like any other tourist. We arrived and there were 2,000 people standing in the street. It was incredible. I've never experienced anything like that. Like, I think that's what it's like to be a celebrity or something. I mean, people were shouting in English. They were waving American and Cuban flags. There were actually people on our cruise of Cuban descent who had family in the area, and they were just sobbing. Like, they were reunited with cousins who they'd never met before, or, you know, someone had passed away and they'd never gotten to say goodbye, but the long lost relative was there. I mean, it was a really, really powerful experience. And that's what's one thing that's so cool about this job that I get to do is, sure, I get to travel to interesting places, but sometimes I spend the whole time in a conference room, like writing down what people say at lectures. And this was something that I'll never forget. It was on television. Like, my mom saw me on the BBC.
And this was for Condé Nast Traveler. Tell me how you got involved with writing for them.
I've been a contributing digital editor at Condé Nast Traveler for about 2 years now. It was sort of an interesting mix of stuff. I was full-time freelance. I thought I would never go back to working in an office again, just because if I'm not traveling, I thought, what am I doing? Where am I generating ideas from? How am I working? But they needed somebody who had kind of a particular set of skills that I had, who had worked in digital media before, who spoke French, who knew Europe really well. They said, can you come in for 2 months and help with a project? And that was 2 years ago.
One other thing that they've also done as well, speaking of being on the radio here, you guys have a podcast as well, correct?
We do. It's called Travelog.
Let's talk about that for a second, the idea of the different forms that travel writing at Condé Nast Traveler takes. What's the digital space like? What's the next step beyond just travel writing? Is the audio and the video side, do you suspect, going to become a larger part of that strategy?
Yeah, I think it already is. And I also think that social media is a huge part of it. There's a really great Sylvia Plath quote about sometimes you have this block of wood and what you want is to make a chair. But if the chair doesn't work, it might actually be better as a table or as a children's toy. And I really like that idea because it's really dangerous to only think about reporting in one way. Something might work really well as a written reported feature, but it might actually work better as a podcast or as a video or as a Facebook Live or as a Snapchat story. And being able to think about stories in different kinds of way and what's the best format for each of them is really exciting. Like, sometimes I do hotel tours. Hotel tours are really boring to write about, even if it's really beautiful. Everyone just wants to see it. So why not do a Facebook Live of a walkthrough of a hotel, or do a Snapchat story so that you can see all the different rooms? That's much more interesting, and it's a better way for people to experience it.
And also, hotels themselves are indeed changing and evolving. A recent story that you filed was Inside Charlotte's Marriott M Beta Hotel of the Future, and all the perks that are out there to meet people who come around in cities like Charlotte. What did you find during that story in Charlotte?
So that was really cool. So the M Beta Hotel is a Marriott in Central Charlotte, but it is, so if you didn't know what you were looking for, it would just be a regular hotel. But if you pay attention, it's actually, this hotel is a sort of test kitchen for the entire Marriott brand. So as you walk around the hotel's public spaces, you start seeing these red buttons, like the ones from Staples. And they're like, press this button if you like the restaurant. Press this button if you like the fitness center. And so people who aren't me and didn't know what they were getting into ahead of time start asking questions. And it turns out that everything is getting real-time feedback. Every element of the hotel is real-time feedback. So I think it's really cool to think, okay, I'm just sleeping a night in a hotel room. Who cares? They're going to forget about me in the morning. And instead it's, if I tell them that I love this pillow, maybe everybody at every Marriott in the world will get this pillow. And it's a really fun thing to be part of. And they chose Charlotte because it's not New York. They wanted sort of a interesting group of people who weren't necessarily staying for a really long time, who don't come every day. They wanted to get a nice sort of cross-section of America, and I think they did.
And then finally, another story that you filed a little bit closer to home advocacy-wise. And that was Dancing with the Stars' Niall DeMarco on Waltzing Deaf and Traveling Solo. Tell me about that.
So I am fluent in American Sign Language. It's my first language. My parents are deaf. It is not a thing I get to use very often at work, which is a shame because I love it. But, you know, I also speak French, and that I use at work all the time. You know, I can go to France, I can go to Switzerland, I can do interviews in French. But with ASL, it's a little bit harder because not as many people use it. So Niall DeMarco is a deaf male model who won the final season of America's Next Top Model. After that, he competed on Dancing with the Stars and ended up winning that. So a couple weeks after he got cast on Dancing with the Stars, I really wanted to interview him, but I refused to contact him. I was like, no, there aren't many people who cover the deaf community in America. I want him to ask me to interview him. And I thought I was being a total child about it. And I was about to cave. And then his manager contacted me. And she said he wants to do more work in ASL. He would love to do more stuff without his interpreter. And it just so happened, these two really incredible things happened the same week that made this piece something special. One is that I was actually already planning to go to LA. So I was in LA for another story, and that's where he was filming the show. So we were able to do something in person. Originally, the plan had been do a Skype interview. And that's fine, but it wouldn't have been as interesting to watch. And so much of sign language isn't just about the signing. It's about you guys being together and playing off each other's energy and interacting. I mean, it's a very physical with your whole body language. So the fact that we could be in the same room was really important. But I didn't know what to ask him about travel. And that's where it got sticky. I thought, I work for a travel magazine, and I really want to do this interview, and it's important to me as a person. Maybe I should freelance it somewhere. And that week, they ask a question of every character or every person on the show that week to sort of prep you for their dances. And that week, it was, what's the bravest thing you ever did? And Niall said, it was traveling the world solo for a year without my interpreter. And I said, that's it. That's the interview. So that was what we talked about. And it was really, I have to give so much credit to the two camera guys who filmed it because we told them it wasn't going to be in English. I was like, neither of us will be speaking. You just have to film us and go with it. And they didn't know how to read any of our cues. They couldn't figure out who to light when. So they just stuck one camera on each of us and went for it. And they had so much faith in me. And I really appreciate that because it must have been so overwhelming for them. And it also meant that I had to translate the entire thing, which was 40 minutes long, so that they could edit it down and know what they were working with. But it was great.
Speaking of video, Eric, you are known for producing your own videos in addition to your writing. Let's talk about your work with National Geographic's Intelligent Travel, both doing the writing for, but also the video experience of doing dog sledding in Quebec and heliskiing 101.
Well, to backtrack, I started doing these videos when I was writing for Discovery, one of Nat Geo's biggest competitors. It's funny that they're both in the DC area and they're not New York. I started doing videos as a contributing writer for Discovery. Originally, I did a video about floating a bowling ball in the Dead Sea in Israel because I was on a press trip in Israel, but I'd already been to Israel on my own. So I knew that I was going to see the same kind of things and I just wanted to mix it up. So I proposed, instead of writing about stuff that I already know, let me do this bowling ball video, which I thought was going to be interesting. I'm a fan of Mythbusters and it's sort of in, like, I always call it like the traveling Mythbusters series. So I did videos for them, and then when the group that I was in was let go from Discovery Communications, I ended up writing for National Geographic, and I continued the same sort of traveling Mythbusters theme of video in as a complement to each of the things I'd post for Nat Geo, one of them being dog sledding in Quebec. The video is focused on dog sledding, but because I sort of take the scientific angle of travel, like it's about whether or not it was cold enough because it was negative 30 Celsius, which is pretty cold because Celsius and Fahrenheit meet at negative 40 or something. So it was like that cold. And I'd always heard that if it's cold enough, you can throw boiling water into the air and it would turn into snow. And I do this video which sort of explains that while also showcasing Quebec and dog sledding in Quebec and how to be a musher. In the video space and travel, I always felt like all of it's like the same kind of fluff. It's always showcasing, you know, the destination, which is great. The better videos know how to find an angle that make it different from the other videos. The whole Anthony Bourdain thing, like he does the food angle, he does it very well. But there's more than that. I feel like there are a lot of copycats who are doing food travel because it's popular and people will watch it. I decided that, like, to make things different, I would do a science angle.
Not just a science angle, but something where you put your body on the line. I don't know how dangerous these are, but I think anytime you're jumping out of a helicopter to go skiing, that's...
It's funny you say that because a lot of people think heli-skiing is like a Mountain Dew commercial or a Red Bull commercial. Like, nobody jumps out of a helicopter. They land, and then you put your snowboard on, and then you go down. It's basically going to remote areas that don't have ski lifts. And instead of a ski lift, you're using a helicopter.
Let's talk about filing stories off the grid. And these are two good examples of that when you're...
Off the grid meaning me being off the grid.
You being off the grid, away from cities, okay. in areas that don't have an electrical connection, don't have Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. The idea...
I hate when there's no Wi-Fi, let me tell you that. That is off the grid.
Is there a percentage of your stories that take you out of the city, this far out of the city, to this type of off-the-grid approach?
Percentage? I mean, my beat has always been adventure travel, so it's probably half and half. Mm. A lot of it is off-the-grid, so to speak, between this and going guerrilla trekking, where there's definitely no Wi-Fi there in the middle of Rwanda. In the middle of the jungles of Rwanda, there's no Wi-Fi.
And I'm glad you said that because that was my next point. I like the pun, amidst the gorillas in the midst.
Yes. Because I love puns, I feel like the one reason I went to Rwanda was so that I could have... I made sure it was on my phone, so it was actually premeditated. I wanted to be able to say that I saw Gorillas in the Mist, the movie... Amidst gorillas in the mist. And it happened. Like, I have a photo of it.
What was it like being that close?
Oh, it's amazing. I still say that my gorilla encounter is probably the number one thing that I've done in the world. It's unlike anything I've done before. I've been on safaris many times. It sounds kind of elitist to say this, but like after the first safari, like they're all kind of the same after the first one. For the, you know, for the big five, but a gorilla trek is, you can only do it in three countries, all within the same area. So basically the same geographic region, if the borders weren't there. And it really is a special thing because you really can tell that they are very human. They behave like a family. Like, you'll see the silverback, the dominant male, just sort of like cross his hands and pick his nose and just like oversee everyone while the kids are actually playing. You can see them like play hide and go seek. The mom is just nursing a child and they're all together, and you can definitely tell that they are a family. And then when the silverback says like, okay, enough time hanging out with these humans, we're gonna go on, like they'll just follow them and they'll just be a family somewhere else.
And I'd have to assume that these gorilla treks, having tourists visit them, and the money that's generated from that, does that go back into the preservation efforts?
Yeah, it does. It's actually, I mean, the price has gone up since I've done it. I did it, what year is that? 3 years ago. And I think a gorilla permit at the time was $400. I think it's around $800 now. It's in the hundreds of people that they allow to see gorillas a day. And I think it was like 200 when I did it, and maybe it's 400 now, but it's still not mass tourism. They are pretty good about limiting the amount of human interaction with the gorillas because, you know, that's just nature's way. But at the same time, it generates a lot of money for the conservation of gorillas. So it's sort of this like balance that the Rwandan government is doing of tourism.
Lily, you touched on this before with regard to hotels, but the idea that people are reading this and taking cues of saying, that looks like something I want to do, and driving, potentially at least, massive numbers of people to travel abroad or travel to a location.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I think about is sometimes, because I work for a publication that people know relatively well, it might be on their radar, I don't like to out myself when I go somewhere, because part of it is just, you know, once I was at a restaurant and I think they realized that I was a Condé Nast Traveler reporter, all of a sudden they started sending over these special dishes that weren't on the menu. It was really nice of them, but at the same time, those aren't things that I can tell a reader to order. And it starts to get in this sticky place where special treatment isn't the treatment that a regular guest would be getting. And I want to be honest with them about their experience. So often, people who run hotels or restaurants think that the way to get us to cover them is to give us all these special upgrades and secret things. And honestly, I don't want them because it doesn't feel fair.
You're listening to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. Lily, let's talk about a story that you filed in an area that you know very well, An Insider's Guide to Raleigh, North Carolina, in time for the Hopscotch Music Festival. When you're trying to sum up, say, a town or an area and find the best of, what's your approach to doing that?
Oh, man. Well, this one was a tough one to do that for because so Raleigh's my hometown. I grew up there. And when I was growing up, I used to read Vogue magazine in my bedroom and think about how culture was busy happening somewhere else and that I would never be invited. And the idea that I got to write for that publication, but that I also got to write about the place that I come from was really exciting. It's exciting that so many cool things are happening in Raleigh, so many people are doing really interesting projects, and having the opportunity to kind of show people why I love my hometown so much was really special. But it also means that I like everything the best. And that I know a lot of the small business owners, I know a lot of the restaurant chefs, and there's this urge to want to tell everything, you know, say that everyone is the best at everything. So I think for me, I just think about, since I don't live in Raleigh anymore, what are the things that I always do when I'm back home? What are the, you know, if I only have 2 days, what are the things that I always get in line to go try or always want to meet my friends to do? And that's a nice place to start. And then I sort of try to run a mix of expensive once-in-a-lifetime things that I might do if I were only visiting once with kind of things that all the locals are obsessed with but that you might overlook because they're kind of low-end. So my favorite thing in the whole world is a chicken joint from North Carolina called Bojangles. It's a chain. I love it. I wrote about them once and they sent me a care package and it was the greatest day of my life. Bojangles is a fast food place. I mean, most people would just walk right past it, and I actually recommend that everybody go there because it's really, if you say, I want to do what the locals do, the locals go to Bojangles on Sunday afternoon. So being able to say that and give it this kind of upscale, hey, I'm writing for Vogue, but I'm telling you to go to this chicken place. But next to it, I can recommend, you know, a restaurant from a chef that won a James Beard Award.
Rather than Condé Nast Traveler, this is Vogue, which is not necessarily the first thing that comes to mind is travel writing. Tell me about the adjustment to voice when it came to filing for that compared to a straight-up travel writing site.
Yeah, that's always kind of fun because with Condé Nast Traveler, what we keep in mind is that people come here, number one, for travel content, and they've most likely been to this place before or know a lot about it or have a close friend who's been, or they've already bought their tickets and they're planning a trip. They're already kind of halfway there. And what you can do is give them more of an insidery look and some stuff that maybe they didn't do the first time they were in town or that they didn't have time to get to the first time around and make a case for it. Whereas with this Vogue piece, because most people were coming in, oh, it's a lifestyle story, then you sort of set the scene a little bit. The opening paragraph is all about, okay, so why would you go to Raleigh? What do you need to know about it? What's the best time of year to go there? And kind of set the scene a little bit and make the case for why they should book the ticket as opposed to a travel site where you assume they've already bought it.
The first thing that jumps out in the first sentence, which I was not aware of, is that Raleigh-Durham only refers to the airport.
Oh, God, this is the hill I'm going to die on, people. Raleigh-Durham is an airport. Raleigh and Durham are separate towns in separate counties. We don't really like each other very much. You sometimes live in one and never go to the other.
And then the other thing to note for those who don't know, the Hopscotch Festival.
Yeah, so Hopscotch is a really cool music festival. It's kind of similar to South by Southwest. So there's music, but instead of having the interactive component that South by has, it has a design-centric edition, which is really cool. North Carolina, for a long time, has been known for textiles, and now there's some really interesting stuff happening with furniture design and graphic design and art installations. So it's a nice way to kind of call attention to the city. And it was exciting for me in New York. Sometimes if I told people I was from Raleigh, they said, oh, I've been thinking about going for Hopscotch. So what's great is if you're doing a broader look at a piece that's kind of an intro to a city that might not be on your radar, having a big event to tie it into that would be an incentive for people from out of town to go there is a great entry point.
And speaking of writing for publications that one might not think of as traditional travel writing, Eric, you filed a report for Gore-Tex titled The Splitboarding Show Must Go On.
For those of you who don't know what splitboarding is, because it was a mystery to me before I realized I was going to do it, a splitboard is a snowboard that pulls apart in the middle and it becomes two skis. I always thought that you had a split board, so you had the option. Like, if you're too cheap to have a pair of skis and a snowboard, you would just have this all in one. That's not actually the case. You put it in snowboard mode to go downhill, and then when they're skis, you put skins on them that provide traction for you to cross-country ski or actually ascend up a mountain with two legs, which you can't do on a snowboard. Funny thing about travel riding is you can take one experience and ride it in many different ways. I've also written a story about splitboarding for Nat Geo, which actually never went online because my editor moved on. But in contrast to the Gore-Tex story, the Gore-Tex story goes into the accident I had. I almost, basically a helmet saved my life because I tumbled down a mountain, hit my head right on the side, my goggles smashed, my helmet dented, I dislocated my finger. The story is called The Splitboarding Show Must Go On is because after my guide had assessed that I probably did not have a concussion, like, we just continued the rest of the trip.
The idea that Gore-Tex, an outdoor wear brand, is getting into travel riding.
Well, Gore-Tex is not the only brand that is getting into branded journalism, as they say. There's many brands are getting into branded journalism, so to speak. It works well for Gore-Tex because they are an outdoor brand, and outdoorsy stories are exciting, and they sort of bring the experience that their audience wants to hear about. I also have written for Drive magazine, which is a property of Subaru, and I always thought that the amazing thing about writing for them is I've never written about a car. I've written about artisanal honey. I've written about sandboarding. I've written about skiing and snowboarding. And I've never once written about a car.
Lalit, any experiences with branded content like that?
Sort of. What I was going to say is I just did a story about a lot of lifestyle brands are starting to branch out into hospitality. So there's kind of a couple different approaches. It may not be that they decide to start a website and do content, but for example, Restoration Hardware is opening a hotel and everything in the hotel is going to be their brand and you can buy it. So for them, it's this idea of, okay, we want to expand our business, but beyond just opening a bunch more stores, what are some things that we can do? And turning a hotel into a showroom and vice versa is a really smart way to do that. Equinox Gyms is opening a hotel. That's going to have a huge fitness center and be really centered toward people who want to work out while they're traveling and want to have equipment that they don't have to bring with them. I think it's a really smart thing to do. And also, I can't tell you how many times I've been at a hotel and really liked something and thought, oh man, I would buy this if I knew where it was from or if I could fit it in my suitcase. And they're just trying to cut out that middle step.
And in both cases, for both of you, were these situations where, say, the brand sought you out because they figured, well, to make this seem smooth, I'm going to get a really good travel writer to write this? Or did you pitch them?
I already had my beat established as being a adventure writer. So Gore-Tex actually found me. Subaru found me. And we went from there. Actually, no. The Subaru, I actually met the editor on a press trip, actually, and then he came to me, yeah. But, yeah.
And that says something, too, the idea that they're seeking you guys out as writers rather than going to, like, the marketing team internally to come up with this stuff.
Yeah, and I'll say that, you know, once you become known for a certain beat, even if it's something really specific, sometimes every writer's dream is to have an editor ask you to write a thing instead of you having to do the work of pitching it. So, you know, I went to Cuba for my job and I wrote a piece about it. But a couple months later, a publication called Domino reached out and said, oh, we're really looking for somebody who can write kind of a nuts and bolts piece about how you actually get to Cuba, how you apply for the visas, because it's pretty complicated. And as Americans, we're pretty lucky that there are a lot of countries we can just show up in without really having to get a visa or do a bunch of paperwork. So it was a trip that I had already been on, but they needed somebody who knew that area pretty well. And I had just gone through the whole process so I could talk about it really knowledgeably. And then even at Condé Nast Traveler, one thing that was interesting is before I worked there, if somebody asked me what my beat was, I said travel. And then I started working for a travel magazine. Everybody's beat is travel. And it really got me to think more deeply about what specifically within travel I was passionate about. So things like, okay, I speak another language. That's a skill that I should use. I'm going to try and pitch more Francophone stories. So we wanted to cover Guadeloupe when a new flight route opened up from New York City. I speak French. I got to go. So advantages like that, even within a company. I mean, I think people think that because you work at a publication, you're just handed assignments, and that maybe you show up at an editorial meeting and then everyone gets their job for the week. And sometimes you're pitching against your own coworkers, or you're making the case for why you should get to cover something instead of somebody else, or why I need to be away the second week of December so that person can't cover the story they want to do that week. So it's always pitching. It just comes in different forms.
And Eric, do you find yourself having a little bit more freedom being essentially purely freelance?
Yes and no. I mean, there are, you know, those magical moments where an editor says like, hey, you'd be perfect for this. Write this for me. I don't know why one of those ideas was write about artisanal honey because you're into food. But I interviewed a bunch of people who produce their own honey with their own beehives, which is actually not my beat at all. But, you know, it's flattering when people think of you as their go-to guy for something like that.
And let's talk about stuff, a couple of stories that might have put you a little bit on the map for that kind of travel writing in terms of really interesting, intense stuff. I speak of two stories you filed for Seeker, one that involved you willingly getting shot, and then another one that involved you using the world's largest magnet to essentially cut cheese.
I didn't file them for Seeker. I filed them for Discovery when I was a contributing writer there. I don't know what happened in the past 6 years where they have just sort of branched out and rebranded their science content or their travel content. When I clicked my old Discovery link, it led me to Seeker. So I guess I'm a Seeker writer now.
Let's do the early one. You are in Colombia, correct?
This is 5 years ago, but this was actually based on an experience from probably 2 years before that. I had always heard that there was a guy in Colombia who made bulletproof business attire, let's say. He has outfitted Steven Seagal very famously because Steven Seagal's picture's everywhere, and Steven Seagal had a custom-made kimono made for him by Miguel Caballero. He's known as the Giorgio Armani of bulletproof clothing because he does these very nice cuts of custom business wear or kimonos in Steven Seagal's case. Rumor is he's actually outfitted Obama when Obama was elected president, and he freely just walked down the street in the parade. People were saying, oh, it's because he's wearing a Miguel Caballero suit. And it's funny because the video that I produced or just like had about me getting shot by Miguel Caballero himself, you know, resurfaced when it was rumored that Obama was wearing his clothing. What I had seen done before is Miguel Caballero will demonstrate very realistically how bulletproof his clothing is. He has this leather jacket that he has people wear. He pulls out a 45? It depends, because my girlfriend at the time also got shot in the stomach, but with a lower caliber handgun. He thought I was man enough to get the bigger gun. So thing he does is that he counts to three, and on three, he pulls the trigger, but he actually does it after two, so you're for shock value. It really is bulletproof. Like, you feel the pressure of the bullet, like, on your body. But that's it. It's just like somebody like punched you a little bit, but your skin is fine. I bruised a little bit, but it didn't last that long. And it is an experience that I'll never forget because, who gets shot in the stomach voluntarily?
So that's a very personal experience of power from a gun. You went from that to dealing with perhaps one of the most powerful man-made magnetic devices ever conceived at CERN in Switzerland. Tell me about that story.
After floating a bowling ball in the Dead Sea, I had befriended a guy, a friend of a friend who worked at CERN, the nuclear research facility known around the world. They have this giant particle accelerator that is miles in diameter underneath Geneva. It's actually underneath both Switzerland and France, because when you're on the CERN campus, you can actually cross the border within the campus. It's funny because I knew that I had an opportunity to shoot any type of video at CERN because I had a hookup there. And I was originally thinking that I was going to have cheese cut by a giant magnet because they mentioned like, oh, maybe you can do something with a magnet. And I had this vision from maybe watching Breaking Bad where there was the episode where Walt and Jesse use a giant magnet to erase evidence from a police station. And everything just sort of like flies against a wall. And I had this vision where I would have like a knife and a magnet, and just like knives just like flying into a piece of cheese and like cutting it. But it doesn't work that way. As I learned from the actual scientists who work there, the particle stream is actually bent so that it can flow into a circle with magnets. You can use that principle to bend any sort of metallic thing. So they suggested we're going to use the same principles as bending the particle stream to bend an aluminum rod. And I had the idea of putting a Swiss Army knife at the end and using it to cut pieces of cheese and determining how much electromagnetic power is required to slice Comté and cheddar and Laughing Cow cheese, like different densities of cheeses. And it turned out to be a really fun video. I actually didn't know if this was actually going to work until the morning that we went there. Like, we had all these travel arrangements set up. We knew that we were going to be there for the experiment. We didn't even know if it was going to work or not yet until the morning of, because they were still scrambling around for a volunteer who would do this. Fortunately, having the Discovery brand under your resume helps. So they're like, oh, if we're going to do it for Discovery, you're like, we'll definitely find somebody. And they found this guy, Louis Walkiers, I think his name is, who only that morning did the test run. We didn't know going in if we could cut cheese at all or if it was going to work. And then ultimately he told me at lunch, he's like, yeah, I tried it this morning. It'll work. And then we set up a bunch of cameras and we did it 4 different cheeses in 1 take each.
Do you think you were more excited to cut that cheese or when they found the Higgs boson particle?
I was more excited about this because Higgs boson was old news already.
You're listening to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. Lee, you've done some travel writing in Asia, and one of the sites you've done that for is petergreenberg.com. It's one of my favorites, is your trip to Taiwan. First of all, tell me about petergreenberg.com, and then tell me how that led to this trip.
Oh, so Peter Greenberg is a guy. You've probably seen him on your television. He, I think, now is a regular on CBS This Morning, who talks about travel intel and tips. The guy has been everywhere. He has a really popular radio show. And then when he started his website, he kind of needed people to help him write for it. So luckily, I knew someone who worked there and pitched a bunch of ideas.
So this is one of my favorite trips you've taken. There's a small town on the coast of Taiwan that has a very intimate connection with a famous animated film.
I mistakenly thought that Taipei was pretty far. It was like the northern tip of Taiwan, which I was totally wrong about. About half an hour north, the actual northernmost tip is a town called Jiufen. And Jiufen's a really beautiful town, but even though it's in Taiwan, it feels very Japanese. There are all these Japanese-style tea houses. It's a really popular holiday getaway for Japanese people who often come over on cruise ships. And one of the people who like to come there is... I'm going to let you say it, Christian.
Miyazaki.
I knew that was why this was your favorite story when you told me that. But yeah, so apparently when Miyazaki was there once on vacation, he looked around and saw images of these black and white faces that ended up inspiring the character of No Face in Spirited Away. So now that people realize that's where he got his inspiration from, there's a very small culture that's kind of sprung up in Jiufen around tourism for Miyazaki.
And then visiting the rest of Taiwan, what's that experience like in the modern day as a culture? What's Taiwanese culture like? What are some of the interesting things that you found out about it?
One reason I'm glad that I went to Taiwan is I was very intimidated by going to Asia. I thought I'd never been before. I didn't really know where to start. It's such a huge, diverse continent. I don't speak any of the languages. I was a little intimidated about, I really wanted to go to Asia, but it's so huge and so many different countries. I didn't really know where to start. And initially, I'd been thinking about China, but I found it very intimidating. You know, you have to get a visa. The internet's always a little bit weird. I didn't want to have to lie about being a journalist. And I came up with the idea, why don't I just go to Taiwan? And I'm so glad I did. It's a great country. A lot of the culture there, of course, is very Chinese, but it's also really becoming its own thing. One thing that I loved about my trip to Taiwan was how proud people are to be Taiwanese. And for such a long time, I mean, they have to compete in the Olympics as Chinese Taipei. Mainland China still claims Taiwan as their own. And there's still a lot of resentment around Chiang Kai-shek, taking a lot of things from the Forbidden City and putting them in the National Museum in Taiwan. So there's a lot of conflict going on there. I think public schools in Taiwan did not even teach Taiwanese history until maybe 20 years ago. I have to verify that. But for so long, all they did was study Chinese history. And it's only recently that they've started to kind of think about who they are as a country and who they are separately. And so that made it a fascinating place for me. It was very Chinese in a lot of ways, but it was also very accessible for me as an American who didn't speak the language. There's a great subway system in Taipei. Everything's very clean, very organized, really well laid out. It was the perfect first entry point for me.
You went to Cambodia, and very famously during the Khmer Rouge time, I believe the saying was, history is over. The idea that basically an entire culture, entire country's past was essentially wiped out. So it's essentially the last 30 years you would think would be on display. What was that like? Was it tough to find the history in Cambodia?
When I went to Cambodia, they are doing Khmer Rouge trials right now. So people are talking about it. It was in the newspapers. It was not a subject people were embarrassed to talk about, which sometimes happens, that people are kind of ashamed of. When I went to El Salvador, everybody wanted to talk to me to make sure that I knew that the war was over. They feel like the only time the U.S. heard anything about El Salvador, it was about the war and how awful it was. And they think that that's why nobody visits. So they really want to get the message out there. Like, guys, the civil war ended 10 years ago. Please come visit. It's totally safe here. And I didn't get that in Cambodia. They've had enough time that I think people know that the country is very different now and relatively safe. And the big thing in Cambodia, of course, is Angkor Wat, which is awesome and everyone should go. But when I went over to Phnom Penh, the capital, the number one thing to do on TripAdvisor in any tour book that you buy is the Killing Fields. And it was strange to me that, of course, it's something really, really tragic and awful, and yet people just go because it's a tourist attraction and there are just these buses full of people from cruise ships who just pop out and want to go see the saddest thing in the entire country. And for me, that was not what I wanted to do at all. And I think that's kind of a controversial opinion. I mean, I did a lot of reading before I went. It was something I wanted to know about so that I didn't accidentally say something offensive. I'm Jewish. When I went to Germany, I did not go to a concentration camp. And even non-Jewish people were saying, oh, we're going to go to Dachau. You know, and it's tourist buses pull up in front of Dachau and people go take photos. And I had no interest in doing that. I'm so glad that these places have been preserved so that we can learn from them. I will never go. And I think that's a controversial opinion to have as a travel writer, is to say there are just certain things that I'm not interested in seeing. But I have seen every Holocaust film. I have read lots of books about it. I don't feel like I'm necessarily missing something by not experiencing it firsthand and like looking at those places and touching them. Frankly, I was more upset to see smiling selfies of people in front of Auschwitz. Like, I don't want to experience that myself.
Sticking with the theme of being Jewish while traveling, you wrote an article on that for Lilith Magazine. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Lilith Magazine is a really cool, independent, Jewish, feminist magazine. And I got in a conversation with one of the editors there about what it's like being a travel writer, but also being Jewish. Because every once in a while, there is a conflict that comes up. There are certain countries that I can't visit or that I don't feel safe visiting, or places that, because I have an Israel stamp in my passport, are going to be a problem for me. I got offered, back when I was able to do press trips, I was offered a free trip to Bali. And like, who turns down a free trip to Bali? And the answer is me. Because I had an Israel stamp on my passport and I was really concerned about not being able to go to Indonesia, or if I did, having difficulty within the country. I don't know if that would have happened. I could have been fine. And I had heard a lot of anecdotal stuff about, oh yeah, I'm Jewish. I went, I was wearing a Star of David, no big deal. And you kind of have to parse that for yourself and decide what you're comfortable with. But there have definitely been places where I don't tell people that I'm Jewish. I don't necessarily advertise the fact.
And sticking with Israel for a second, across the river in the West Bank, Eric, you follow the story from there. Tell me about the wild, wild West Bank.
So when I was in Israel the first time independently and not tied to the Israeli Ministry of Tourism, which would shun upon me going into the West Bank through the back door with the American Jewish woman that I met, that I'm still friends with now in New York. I don't know. I heard about and read about trekking through Wadi Kelt, which is supposed to be this amazing trek through the desert along a riverbed between Jerusalem and Jericho. I sort of became obsessed with going on this trek because there's this aura of adventure about it where other people that I'd met who had gone on the trek said, like, oh yeah, like we were just like chilling by the river, and then this guy with a gun was just like waving us out of there, and it was exciting, like, which sounds weird, like a lot of people find that as a draw, but I did. And fortunately my now friend Sarit thought it would be adventurous too. The whole idea, like, of the warnings about going into the West Bank was not because of any political tension. One guy that I'd met in Israel said, like, the issues aren't going to be traveling with a Jew in the West Bank. It's going to be because of the Bedouins, because there's no politics. Like, they just see you as an outsider and they just don't want you there. So with that said, like, we went in and it turned out to be this really deserted trek. Like, we expected to see the foliage that lines the riverbank, but it was so dry, there was none of that. We encountered two Bedouin shepherds that they had a gun, but only to, like, for critters. And they were actually really friendly. And, like, we just went on this trek. And the only threat to us doing this trek was not knowing where we were, because we didn't have a smartphone, and running out of water. And we thought we were just going to be stranded in the middle of the desert with no direction, because we had none, and no water, which we had none at the end. Fortunately, for some reason, we found an aqueduct that we had not read about, that we just figured, oh, let's just follow the aqueduct to wherever it goes. And it ended up going to this Gregorian monastery in the middle of nowhere, which was connected to a road that went to Jericho. So once we followed this aqueduct that led to a monastery, which was deserted, we met a Bedouin there who sort of lent his donkey for us to go to the main road. And we kind of just followed the main road into town from there. But without his help, like, we would have been stranded.
Lily, do you have any stranded experiences that have happened to you during your travels?
I don't know if this is because I'm a woman or just because of the way that I prefer to travel, but I feel like I always do way more planning than I need to, because I'm afraid of ending up in situations like that but not feeling safe. So I don't do a lot of country stuff by myself. Like, if I'm in a city, I'm not too worried about it. There'll be lots of people around. I can ask someone for directions. I can pop into a Starbucks and use the Wi-Fi if I need to. It doesn't feel very dangerous. But once you get further afield, I tend not to do that stuff on my own. Like, I'll join an organized tour or try to meet up with a friend or something. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying those incidents haven't happened because I'm a superior planner. It's just that I'm kind of nervous about those sorts of things anyway and tend to overcompensate, I guess.
When you're in these amazing places and your eyes and your minds are on experiencing this stuff, what are your note-taking techniques to make sure you file a detailed story? Is it paper? Is it on your phone? Is it digital? What's your approach?
It's a little of everything, but mostly my phone. I take a ton of photos that are just for my own personal use. I mean, I have like a nice camera for taking photographs, but for snapshots, I use my phone. It's the kind of thing where maybe there's not a paper copy of the menu, and honestly, even if I took it, I might lose it and find it crumpled up at the bottom of my suitcase 6 months later. So I'll always take a photo of the menu or try to circle the name of the thing that I ordered, especially if it's the kind of place where they don't have a menu online. I always take photos if I go into a shop, even if I don't buy anything. I'll take a picture of their card so that I remember the address or a particular item that I liked. If there's a painting at a museum I think is really cool, I always take a photo of the card next to it so I remember the painter's name. That's the kind of stuff that I used to tell myself, no, remember, it's fine. Or I take these really disorganized notes. But for me, since I'm really visual, it's super helpful to have those things together. Like, here's a picture of the painting, here's a picture of the description. And I also use Foursquare a lot, not necessarily to share things, but to keep my own notes. Sometimes they're even private check-ins that I don't show other people, but it's a nice way to be able to go back through and remember what order I did stuff in, which thing is close to which other thing. Oh, I must have gone to that store and then gone to that coffee shop because they're down the street from each other. And I can also leave myself little notes about, that was the place where the bathroom light is impossible to find in the ladies' room. And I leave myself a note about how to do it.
Eric?
Yeah, I'm the same way. It's a mix of paper and digital. I say as of late, it's more digital because my phone's on me all the time and I don't necessarily have a pen on me because I'm... Who has a pen? You never have a pen at the right time. But you, for some reason, we all have our phones because we can't live without those anymore. Same sort of deal. Like, I'll take a picture and then the card next to it, so I'll have the information. Instead of Foursquare, I do a lot of my note-taking on Instagram, because I'm reminded of a photo and I I feel like the photo will jog my memory back to everything that I did in that instance, and then I'll sort of write down the notation, the location, and the circumstances of the photo.
One reason that I use Foursquare and that I use it privately is sometimes I don't want to share on social media where I am and what I'm doing. Sometimes I want it to be a little bit more low key. It's a small industry. A lot of people in travel know each other, and I don't want a rival reporter to know where I am and what I'm working on. I was in Buffalo a couple weeks ago working on this really fun story about a gorgeous Frank Lloyd Wright home that was rescued and restored and finally opening to the public again. So I was fine with people knowing that I was in Buffalo, but I didn't post or share anything related to being at the Darwin Martin House or any of the Frank Lloyd Wright attractions. I just didn't want to tip my hand too much. And then when I did finally publish the story, then that's when I shared everything as sort of supplemental material, so that if somebody saw the Frank Lloyd Wright photo on my Instagram, there was a thing to direct them to, like a link to send them to. So I do a lot of that.
Well, I was going to say, I agree. Like, not everything is on Instagram. I was in Hawaii a couple of weeks ago shooting a video for, you know, another traveling Mythbusters thing, which I've branded as plausibly ridiculous. And the details of what happens in that episode were not on Instagram at all. It, like, they know that it's going to be in Hawaii, but what is actually going to happen when it comes out was not revealed yet.
There is being a freelancer, there is being in-house, but then there is carrying your own identity, your own brand around. Tell me about how you've done that with this branding, plausibly ridiculous.
Well, I mean, as we've been saying, I started out doing videos under Discovery and then under Nat Geo, but they were always like these accompaniments to things that I filed. And I realized at a certain point this year that nobody knows that they're actually a part of a series, because they definitely have a formula. A question is posed, and then there's a little destination-focused story. And then there's this experiment going on about what you can do at this place in terms of science. But it was only me, but you know, the guy who produced them, that knew that they were actually in a formula, because as a reader, all the stories are not collected because they're at two different publications, actually. And at a certain point this year, I decided, like, oh, I actually own all the content. It was always licensed to them, but I still retain all the rights. And I decided that they should be a series, because they are. So I branded them under the name Plausibly Ridiculous. And that's sort of become my own brand based on work that I've done at other places.
And Lalit, even though more recently you've been associated with Condé Nast Traveler, I have to assume that that must be a consideration yourself, right? I mean, one of the sites that you're on is called Lalit Goes. So it's, and you had a long identity as a travel writer freelance before this. What's your approach to your own personal brand, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm bad at that question. I try to just think about what are the things that I'm most interested in and the things that I know the most about. And those sort of, you can call them a brand. I think that's ultimately what they become. But they're also the things that I like doing and the things that I'm passionate about. And there were some that I didn't even think about, to be honest. Sometimes it's really helpful for me to kind of ask friends to read my work and tell them what pops out. For example, you know, I didn't realize this, but I had done a lot of writing about religion and travel. And it had never really occurred to me to think about it that way. But you know, I always visit a synagogue if there's one in a place that I visit, or I'm really into architecture. So a lot of times there's a cool church or a cool mosque. And I wrote a piece once about, you know, how to dress or behave if you're traveling to holy sites around the world and how to make sure that you're covered up appropriately if you need to be, stuff like that. And one of my friends said, yeah, I love that thing you're doing with religion and travel. That's really helpful. And I thought, shit. And so now I have to act like it was my plan the whole time. But I do think that your own interests and your own talents kind of end up bubbling up to the top anyway, even if you don't necessarily plan for that to happen. I mean, writing about deafness and deaf culture in ASL is super important to me, but there isn't really a central publication that I cover that for. And frankly, there aren't many of them out there. So I've written about deaf culture in ASL for Condé Nast Traveler and for Pacific Standard and for the Wall Street Journal. And all these stories are very different from each other. But I think if you looked me up, you would see this kind of unifying thing that I'm really passionate and knowledgeable about. And that's helped me to get more work in that space. I mean, I've been told by people a bunch of times, oh, yeah, I was just looking up this one article and then I found seven other things and they were all written by you. And that was such a cool, gratifying feeling. It made me feel like, oh, I'm building something. And as a freelancer, it can be hard to feel like you're building that kind of identity. And when you work at a brand, you feel like you're building the brand and not yourself. So I like to ask myself this question periodically when I get in kind of a rut about work. What am I building? What am I making? And that's the sum total of my life and my work and my relationships and all of it. What am I making? What am I building?
As travel writers, you kind of only have one shot at your location when you're there. You can't necessarily get sick and not be able to file your story. What's your approach to eating and drinking when you're on assignment?
Here's one story. I often have this habit, I guess, it is a hobby, let's say, where I'll go to a restaurant and the menu's not in English at all. I was in Campo Grande, which is in the middle of the Pantanal in Brazil. I forget what it said on the menu, but I just like, I'll have this. And I just pointed at it. And this platter comes out and I'm like, oh, these look like, it's weird. They kind of look like sausages, but they're like just the tips of sausages. Like, does this mean tips of sausages on a plate? And I was like, whatever, I'll just start eating them. And halfway through, I'm like, I decided that I like them already. Let's look it up. And I was just eating a plate of chicken hearts, which I can't say that I don't like because I loved them before I knew what they were. And now I'm a big fan of chicken hearts. And I feel like not knowing, a lot of people are like, I won't eat if I don't know what it is. I feel like that's the wrong approach from a travel writer point of view, because you should not have that judgment, but yeah, that prejudgment.
Bottled water, tap water, what's the water approach when you're traveling?
Depends where I am. I was in Japan last week and I drank tap water, but I wouldn't do that in Ethiopia.
Lalit, tell me about your approach to eating and drinking on assignment.
So I feel bad. I knew Eric and I were going to have opposite answers to this question, but I'm a little bit of a choosy eater and I try to be as accommodating as possible. I don't want to, especially if people are hosting me in their home, you know, I don't turn things down and I don't want to be rude, but I don't eat pork and I'm not kosher. So I don't have those restrictions to worry about. Like, I eat shellfish. It doesn't need to be blessed by a rabbi. It's fine. But I personally haven't eaten it in a long time and I don't want to. So depending where you are in the world, that's kind of a challenge. But it means that I will tell myself I have to eat anything else on the menu. And sometimes it ends up being something like chicken hearts, which, by the way, are tasty. I had chicken testicles in Taiwan, and they're actually kind of good. I felt okay about it. So I tell myself if I'm going to restrict one thing, that can be the only thing. I have to be really open to everything else. And I also don't drink coffee, but I'm a big tea person. So one really nice way to get to know people when I'm traveling is I always set up, especially if I'm going to meet with someone or I'm interviewing a source, I'll say, oh, what's the local tea that I need to try? Or is there a particular tea shop that's really famous? Can we go there? And that's always a nice little way to get into a culture, but it's such a nice way to open that door. Like, I've had coca tea in Chile, or pink Kashmiri chai. There's been all kinds of fun stuff that I might not have known about otherwise. And then it becomes a cool, easy souvenir that I can bring home for myself, is sort of try some of this cool new tea.
How important are World Heritage Sites in your estimation for driving tourism?
If there is a UNESCO site, I will go because I know there's something relevant or interesting about it. And I get really into the like cross it off my list kind of thing. What I love about it is also that you get money from UNESCO to preserve these places. But one thing I will say, Angkor Wat was a sadly good example of this, is it's too popular. Angkor Wat is too popular. Mm-hmm. People love it. And it is such a huge moneymaker for the country. And it's not a wealthy country. They can't afford to turn that revenue down. But I do think they need to put some sort of system or controls in place. You know, look at what Machu Picchu is doing. You know, they have timed entry. You can only have a certain number of people per day come in. So they can still make a ton of money off of it, but they're at least taking care of the site really well. And at places like Angkor Wat or the pyramids in Mexico City, there are just people everywhere. And it's so scary. You look at the erosion that's going on. At the pyramids, I honestly thought people were going to fall off the top because there wasn't any kind of barrier or any protection and everyone was jostling each other out of the way to take selfies. I was honestly afraid somebody was going to fall off and get killed.
How beneficial do you each suppose tourism is to these countries? Is it more of a pestilence at this point than it is a positive?
It depends who you're talking to. I feel like I've been covering this beat a lot about places that have become too popular and how they're handling it. Reykjavik has maybe 10 times as many tourists as it does actual residents at this point. Barcelona's new mayor wants to impose a tax on people who come for the day on cruise ships because they're not spending money staying at hotels. The locals of Venice, there are a lot of them who try to chase tourists out of the city and put up signs telling everyone to go home because you're not welcome here and you're destroying our city. I have noticed anecdotally that whenever I write these kinds of stories and we share them on Condé Nast Traveler, we share them on social media, everyone comments, I agree. I think this is so great. It's really important as long as I still get to go. So everyone thinks it's fine as long as all the rules apply to other people.
I feel Rwanda is a really good example of a country that has figured it out because guerrilla tourism is one of their biggest industries. I don't know if it's their actual number one industry. It might possibly be. They limit the number of people. The price tag is pretty expensive, so that's a filter in itself. Locals and other associated African nations pay a lower fee, so it's fair to them. The guerrillas are conserved. The money goes mostly to the guerrillas. But overall, like, Rwanda has gone through some shit, and they've rebuilt a society that many people in Africa consider the model African nation right now. It's super clean. It's been criticized for being almost too perfect because they are led by a benevolent dictator, so to speak. But everything is like in order because they're kind of trying to sweep under the carpet their past, which works in some ways. You can tell there's a little bit of tension there, but everything's clean because they're mandated to clean the streets once a month and everyone chips in. And they just feel like it's their duty, and they're shamed if they're not. Even amongst themselves, they're just like, oh my God, you didn't clean today. There's no plastic because plastic bags are banned in the country, and everyone just walks around with a brown paper bag, and it's kind of funny to see. I mean, in my experience, everyone's just really nice. Like, there's enough international tourism there because of the gorillas that people sort of understand each other and know why you're there.
Thank you both for sharing your experiences on Talking Paper here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you, Lalit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. You're welcome.
You can follow Lalit Marcus on Twitter at Lalit Marcus and Eric Trinidad at The Global Trip. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.